Hi, I'm Aaron Harmon.
And I'm Leslie Cooper. Welcome to Inside Out Quality.
Leslie and I are quality nerds. We like to figure out what could go wrong and how it could be prevented. Kappas are our friend. How can we use quality to build better, safer products? Can quality be a tool entrepreneurs use for success?
On this podcast, we talk to some fascinating guests and listen to their stories about quality events gone both right and wrong. We dissect these stories to teach and learn from the experiences of our guests. So grab your coffee, secure the lid, ensure it's not too hot, and enjoy our episode.
This is the final episode for season 3. It's also the final in the series on Scott Jerome Parks. When exploring radiation therapy safety, I talked with ASTRO, the American Society for Radiation Oncology. They connected me to Dr. Todd Pellicky. While talking with Todd, he mentioned someone he met on a ski lift who had known Scott personally. The man he met was Dr. Joel Carter, a palliative care physician. I began learning about Joel as a way to understand Scott more, but then realized the episode shouldn't be about Scott specifically when I visited Joel's website. I saw his TEDx talk. It's all about the therapeutic power of stories. My podcast is a collection of stories, so it felt fitting that this last episode be about stories, and it was Scott's story that got us here. Welcome to Inside Out Quality, Joel.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation and for having me this morning.
You're here today because of a ski lift ride you were on, in which you met Todd.
Correct.
But before you got on that ski lift, you were a physician. How did you get into medicine? What was the background and what ultimately led you to have this connection to the case of Scott Parks?
Well, I think maybe the best center point of that question is really family. You know, my father was a physician. He was a vascular internist. My dad, Stephen Carter, has quite a story. I'll say on a couple of points of his life journey is that my dad was a Holocaust survivor surviving the Warsaw Ghetto. And I won't get too much into his story, but his story of survival and coming to Canada is quite an amazing one, and how this young orphan dad of mine got into medicine with English being a second language and becoming one of the top in his class at the University of Manitoba, where he had emigrated to Winnipeg. And so I think there's two factors there. One, I guess it was a bit of a family business, and I can say in terms of my memory bank, sort of walking through the halls at a very early age at the Faculty of Medicine at the Medical College at the University of Manitoba, left an imprint, although it took me, you know, decades to find my way back there in terms of a career in medicine. I would say that there's a bit of the Holocaust in being a second-generation survivor, because there have been lots of studies of second-generation survivors that I think demonstrates that second-generation survivors, a wide majority, 80%, if not more, are in service industries. So I'm sure that may have been a bit of a factor as well, being a second-generation survivor, having my dad's history at the University of Manitoba, being a vascular internist, doing a little research project with him in the summer, and actually even during medical school when I eventually got in, doing a research in a number of different areas. I'll also say the other big influence was that I was a pediatric echotech and worked in an exercise lab when I was a bit of a track bum and middle distance runner in my exuberant youth. And I worked with a pediatric cardiologist, two of them, Dr. Gordon Cummings, who is quite renowned in Winnipeg in terms of exercise physiology, and also Dr. George Collins, who I think had a big influence on me as I was able to witness as a cardiac technician and an echo tech, just the magic that George could weave with the families and the children that he cared for. I sort of stood in awe of the relationships that he built and how in the midst of illness and worry, he could set people's and parents' worry at ease. He was just a bit of a Jedi Knight in terms of the relationship building that I found quite impressive. And I think it was George and after my track career that, well, what comes next? And I'd also say even the degree of the highly competitive track career I had in the college, and actually we had a number of fellow middle distance runners who we started a study group in terms of our pre-med studies, and we all got into medicine, I think really because of some of the life lessons that being a middle distance runner and, you know, under intense training and forming relationships and working together was really part and parcel of the reasons that I guess I was successful along with the rest of our group in terms of getting admitted to the University of Manitoba. I guess we were the class of 1991. So I think, you know, those were some of the main factors that I think got me to where I am today. I went through the residency training programs. Was initially a emergency physician and worked at Health Science Center in Winnipeg, the main referral center of the province of Manitoba, and eventually was recruited to Duluth, Minnesota, where I worked for a number of years as an emergency physician in Minnesota. And then I was fortunate enough to obtain a fellowship to transition to pain and palliative care, where I had a wonderful experience in Boston at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, honing my skills and going through the training program. And for the last many years, I've been a palliative care doctor, working initially at the University of Minnesota as an attending doctor in the program, contributing to the fellowship training program there. And I've been at Park Nicollet Methodist Hospital in St. Louis Park in Minnesota for, oh, I think 18 years now.
Wow. I've been to that hospital a number of times back when I would work on an ambulance and transport patients there.
Well, I think we have excellent care in Minnesota. We have probably have some of the best medical facilities in the world. I think I'm very lucky to be where I'm at. And we have an excellent clinical culture amongst our clinicians, where, again, coming from a background where being a team sport and relying on our colleagues and having a positive work relationship has been one of the best places that I've worked at, you know, during my medical career.
You ended up crossing paths with the Parks, with their story. But when I was learning about yourself and visited your website, I came across a TEDx talk you had done about the power of stories and a patient named Margaret. I would love to hear about that story and have you share that with listeners.
So that poem, I think, really frames an awful lot about you know, my encounter with Margaret, who, when I was at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and training as a fellow, I was asked to go see Margaret on the ward. And Margaret was a 53-year-old patient who had a very end-stage case of metastatic breast cancer with a superficial tumor that was spreading and enveloping her, one of the worst that the Dana-Farber cancer doctors had actually ever seen in their careers. And she was very uncomfortable, and her devoted husband, I remember, was sitting very close on her bed. And I walked in with one of the interns who was rounding with me to see if I had learned anything. And she had significant cancer pain. And we usually use, in complex cancer pain, a medicine known as methadone, which addiction specialists use for something different. But methadone is very good for cancer pain because it has neuropathic coverage and other attributes that make it very helpful. And so we started her on some methadone, and I came back a day or so later to check how she was doing, and she was much more comfortable, her devoted husband still at her side, and she was probably within days of dying. and having, as I would say, sort of one foot in both worlds, maybe dabbing your toes on the other side, testing the waters, but still present and able to converse. And, you know, in the midst of my assessment, chatting with her, you know, sometimes you end up asking the right question at the right time for reasons that you don't know what were. But for some reason, I said to Margaret, I said, "Margaret, you're 53 years old." And she said, "Yes, I am." And I said, "So, Margaret, you've lived 53 years of stories." And she said, "Yes, I have." And then I said, "So, Margaret, of all the stories you've lived, what was one of the best?" And without much of a pause, she said, "When I met him," referring to her husband who was holding her hand and sitting right on her bed. So I said, "How did you meet?" And she said, "Well, I was a single mom. I was working in Boston. I was working at a grocery store, and he came through the checkout line. I was one of the cashiers, and he had come through a number of times, at my cash register, and he had asked me out a number of times, and each time I had, not been so interested, but he seemed to be persistent, and he seemed to be a nice guy. So eventually I relented and decided to go on a date for him." And then I said, "Where did you go?" He said, "Well, we just went down the street to a local pub, and we sat, we chatted, and we had a beer." And I said, "What beer did you order?" And she said, "A Guinness." And as she's telling this story, the intern who is back with me at my side sort of leans over and whispers in my ear, "This is better than any morphine that we've given her." Knowing that in the midst of, as she was telling the story, there was this change in energy that it's sort of hard to describe, but you become involved or just present, in the magic of the story. And so what the intern and I did after that was that we left the hospital, we ran down the street to the closest liquor store, and we got a couple of cans of Guinness, and we went up to the top of the Brigham Women's Hospital where she was at, and we got some very nice glasses from their upper floors, and we poured them this Guinness, and it was this sacred moment where the sacred symbols of really their life and relationship could sort of come full circle, from the start to the end. And it was this magical moment for them and really for us to participate in. And she died peacefully a couple of days later. But that encounter left a significant impact, because then it harked back to this quote, from Leslie Marmot Cinco about, well, do stories really protect us from illness and death? Mm-hmm. Because it certainly changed. And it made me wonder, and sort of being in the hallowed halls of, Dana Farber and Brigham and Women's, and part of the Harvard system, where there's this highly intellectual, highly academic approach and sophisticated research. And I'm a little bit of a outsider coming from where I was coming from Winnipeg and Duluth. And it was almost, I don't know the exact word, but apart from everything else, well, perhaps they're missing the boat, that the research is certainly really important, but at the core end of it, it's really about supporting the stories of people's lives. And so I did a research project where I began to interview patients during our, formal consults, and I would do a number of pain scores at the beginning of the consult, including scores for how they would rate their sense of well-being or nausea or other symptoms. And at the end of the consult, before I would finish it, I would ask them this question, at least the treatment group, I would ask, of all the stories you've lived, what was one of the best? And I would try to engage these patients on these wonderful stories that they would share with me. And there was a pattern of what those stories were. And at the end of the stories for that treatment group, where they were the storytelling group patients, I would ask them again what their scores were of pain, their sense of well-being, and their scores of nausea. And what I found was that their pain scores went down significantly, which I thought was really interesting and really important. And it seemed to me that really that intern who was sitting with me when he said, you know, this is better than any morphine that we've given, that maybe it actually was true and wasn't that magical, and whether that really supports this magic of the power of storytelling and how it can impact healing and even symptoms.
When you tell the story of Margaret to me, like, I could feel myself being affected by the story. Like, it's hard to listen to without feeling empathy and all of these feelings welling up inside.
And then certainly in terms of pain research, that you know, there are just amazing researchers who have looked at a number of the brain mechanisms on functional MRIs and on the networks of brains, and also certain areas of the brain that highlight up and how they begin to sort of flare with the activity of engaging in stories. But I think this is somewhat similar to, you know, the benefits of things like art therapy or music therapy, of how we can use our own physiology to our, you know, to our benefit. And I think it's true that using these stories or art therapy in some ways on other dimensions are just as good as morphine. You know, I remember a number of years ago, I had an unfortunate mountain biking incident where I broke my hip and had it fixed and whatnot. And I remember during the day, the pain wasn't so bad because my brain was so active with different things or engaging things. The real challenge was when I was going to sleep, where I was trying to quiet my brain. And I think there was less interference or less static. And so the pain signals were significantly stronger. So I think there's certainly a lot of amazing research that is going on in terms of not only chronic pain, but certainly, you know, malignant pain. And then we get into a whole other dimension about what healing is all about, even in the midst of end-stage illness, that there's still magic that can occur. And certainly in the field of palliative care, which I was drawn to, I have this saying, I don't get surprised anymore when I get surprised. And, you know, the ability to be in these sacred spaces and to see the themes of what people share, I think it also offers us a life lesson for our own lives with our, you know, dying fellow humans who are reflecting back of what's most important. And these stories have these themes. And then I would sort of title what the themes of these various stories were. And for the vast majority of these stories, I would say that these stories are about deep connections, even love stories. Usually the stories, if I remember the titles of some, would be when I first met my wife, the day I got married, the day my children were born, and on and on. So these deep sacred connections, you know, at the end of our life journey, as we're reflecting back about what the human journey was all about, I think it's, you know, pretty simple about what's most important. And it's a real privilege to be able to be present to really help with some of these advanced symptoms, where I've often thought as a palliative care physician, we can do great symptom management and we can improve pain and we can make sure people are sleeping and doing the best that they can. But I think we allow them this window of opportunity to be with their families in meaningful ways, and also to be able to share what the most important stories are that are carried on cross-generationally, and also offer the opportunity to have healing discussions and offering, you know, those that will come after us encouragement, love, and forgiveness for things that, as just being human beings, we all carry to some degree.
So when Margaret's husband was there, I'm assuming there was an effect on him as well.
Profoundly, I think. I will say, when we have in our field what's called family meetings, trying to decide what's most important, you know, for patients sometimes who can't speak for themselves and there's conflict, and sometimes it can be very difficult circumstances. I will just say, just as the whole room changed with Margaret and asking that story, things can change significantly in the midst of these difficult and challenging family meetings when, you know, the question is asked, you know, tell us what he was like at his best. What did he love to do? What was one of the most favorite things for him to be involved with? And it's amazing. Once you open that window, the stories come, and I think the healthcare providers have a better understanding of who the patient was in his, you know, best of days and how it impacted the family. And I think it sets a different kind of tone. And physically, I really mean that. Physically, the energy in the room changes if you engage in meaningful stories of not only the patients, but how it impacts a family. And because I think setting the stage for how we heal and how we grieve our losses and the losses of our loved ones that will inevitably come to each and every one of us.
And it sounds like stories had an effect on even your career choice getting into medicine.
No, I think it was always there. And even going through medicine, you know, I remember hearing my father describe just the journey of his medical class and the fun and the pranks that would happen. And I was a little older than some of my classmates, having had a track career prior to coming in. But going into medicine, I thought these next 4 years are going to be amazing. Mm-hmm. And so we had a very wonderful group of classmates, and going through medicine or any very difficult and severe training program, you have to come to rely on each other and build friendships that will last a lifetime. And in the back of my mind, I thought that I really wanted to pay attention to the experience of going through medicine with this group and contribute as best I could to generating good stories that years and decades later, that at our reunions that we would remember. And it's just amazing as we continue to go back and sort of laugh about our foibles and our challenges, and as being young learners, you know, what we learned from our mistakes and how we cared, supported, and even joked around with each other, which really was a part of a survival strategy to get through what that training program was like back in the days, as they say.
Yeah, that poem makes perfect sense.
Absolutely.
Now we'll take a quick break to hear from one of our sponsors.
Today's startups become tomorrow's growth engines. In South Dakota, we're entering a new stage of expansion for our biotech industry, and you'll want to be part of it. Hi, I'm Joni Johnson, Executive Director of South Dakota Biotech. We're the state affiliate of the International Bio Organization, and we're proud to be leading a state that's driving innovation to feed, fuel, and heal the world. South Dakota Biotech is here to inform, to connect, and to advocate for our critical industry. Whether you're directly involved in biotechnology or looking to learn more about it, we want to hear from you. Find us at www.sdbio.org. Now, back to the show.
I wanted to tell more stories on this episode, so I reached out on Facebook and asked if anybody had been treated for cancer with radiation, and I got a handful of responses. Deb Murphy was one that reached out. Here is her story.
Well, I'm going to go back to like about 97, 98, and I was getting secondary infections. It seemed like I was going to my doctor every couple of weeks. I'd get bronchitis, and I'd have a cold, and that'd get, you know, I'd recuperate from that, and then pretty soon I'd be back in the doctor's office again. And that one finally got me to the doctor going back, because my hair gal that cut my hair for years said, Deb, your hair is falling out in my hands. You have something wrong. You need to go back to your doctor and be more insistent that they do more testing. So I went back to my internist, and he palpitated my neck, and he felt a mass. And he said, okay, I want you to go into the hospital early in the morning, and we're gonna go check you. It's only a 4% chance that this is going to be cancer. I thought, great odds. So I was very nonchalant. I didn't even tell anybody where I was going. I didn't tell my husband. It's just like another ordinary day. And then when I went in there, they said it was a cold mass. And then the doctor, anyway, he called me and he said, Deb, you have thyroid cancer. We need you to come into our office. And that's when I started asking the questions. I said, whoa, is positive? And he said, yes. I said, I want my care transferred to the University of Washington. I knew it was a teaching hospital, but I also knew people that worked there. So I went over there, made an appointment with a head and neck surgeon, and I requested that they have a plastic surgeon on hand. I said, I don't want a lot of scars on my neck. Make sure I'm on the first floor if I do need surgery, because I like to sing. So anyway, I went in there, had my first surgery. I went back after my two-week check. And by that time, my husband didn't know. And the surgeon said, well, Deb, we have great news. You have great skin. You're healing really well. So I said, okay. I said, what's the bad news? Well, he said, it's spread into your strap muscles and it has gone into your lymph nodes. And so we're accelerating this. We need you to come back and schedule as soon as possible for the surgery. And I said, well, you mentioned that if I'm going to get a cancer, this is the best one to get. It's so treatable. I questioned, well, what are you going to do now after I've had these two surgeries? Well, we're going to send you to an endocrinologist now. And that's where I met Dr. Elaine Henley at the University of Washington. I called her the grand dame of endocrinology. You guys would love her. I wish she could live forever. She was such an interesting woman. But she said, Deb, your cancer is aggressive. I'm going to treat you aggressively. We're going to give you the gold standard of care. So we are ordering in radiation. They're going to be a little pill, and you're going to take these. And then you're going to be in a leaded room for a few days. We are going to give you a massive amount. So I thought, okay, great. So in the meantime, I called a Dr. Kenneth Ain from University of Kentucky, and he's probably one of the world's foremost authorities with thyroid issues, but he's also endocrinology, diabetes, and I think metabolism is what he deals with. Just incredible people willing to share information. And then, so I just started asking lots of questions. And this Dr. Kenneth Ain actually returned my phone call. It was a cold contact. He didn't know me. I just did some research. So anyway, I went in, got my little pills. And the next thing I know, people, I'm in the elevator and heading up to those, I can't remember what floor it was in the University of Washington in Seattle. And they said, everybody out of the elevator. We have it's radioactive patient. And everybody had to exit the elevator except for one person who had a lead outfit on and myself, who I was not protected, but because they were giving me this, and they had been flown out from Portland, Oregon, specifically for me. Then I went into the leaded room. And seriously, within a short period of time, I didn't feel good. They said, we want you to suck on lemon drops and whatever you had taken into the room with you, including paperback books, that's what they recommended, whatever goes in doesn't come out. So the food was delivered. It stayed in the room. It was delivered on paper plates. So after four days, I think it might have gone into the fifth day. Imagine all this food in your room. Things aren't pleasant, but you don't feel good. You're wearing the same clothes that you came in with because they don't want to throw too much stuff away. And then they held a Geiger counter to the front of the door. And nobody that's pregnant, like a nurse or anybody who's in medical care, can be on that entire floor. That was pretty surreal to me, but I felt so yuck. And then I went home. And at that time, they said that I still had radiation that it's in your urine, it's expressed through your skin. But if I hadn't have had that, I don't know where I'd be at today if I hadn't had that radiation.
Pam McKinney also reached out. Pam and I had known each other for 15 years. 10 of those years we were working together. She too faced a cancer diagnosis. Here is her story.
When I was diagnosed, I was one day into a new job on a Friday. Got a phone call, couldn't leave the job. Luckily, I was with a friend, but I made them tell me the diagnosis over the phone because I had been in for samples and I knew it was either going to be a yes or no. And it was a Friday, so I made them tell me that I had cancer and basically worked through the day. Got home and told my husband, who we was busy building our house that we had started right before I lost my job. And I had to wait, I think, a week before I went in and met with my doctor team. And I'd say that 10 days is probably the worst part of the story.
Oh, I bet.
Because you do a lot of Googling, which you should never, ever, ever do when you are diagnosed with anything. Never Google symptoms. That was the beginning of the story and the worst part of the story, probably.
So then treatment options. What did treatment options look like when you met with the doctors?
I believe it was surgery first and then treatment, which was going to be chemo no matter what, even if it was in lymph nodes, and then radiation. And the length of radiation was the question. Otherwise, it would be chemo first, then surgery, then radiation. Basically, it was two options, and part of those options depended on whether the lymph nodes were positive or not. So I had to wait then for testing.
What was treatment like?
First, I had surgery. Then I was able to do the treatment. So I had surgery. The surgery was much, much easier than I thought. I had my surgical tech friend handpick doctors, some of the doctors and the staff that was in the room for me, with me, which was kind of nice because she was also in there and I had some trust then in what was going to happen when I was under and in surgery. So I did surgery to remove the tumor and then reduction to help with that. And they tested lymph nodes. And then I basically was staining ceilings in my house and out on the boat that weekend. I remember I had surgery on Wednesday and I was out on the boat on the weekend. It was one of the simplest surgeries I had, but I think they did some sort of block to help with the pain. So it really wasn't too bad, and I was back to work on Monday.
And then was it chemo next?
And then I waited 6 to 8 weeks and started chemo, and I did 4 rounds of chemo. By the end of that, I was ready to be done. No throwing up, no awful symptoms, just it felt like you had a case of the flu for a good week, and you were tired, and you didn't think right, but you overwhelmingly tired was probably the worst. But I remember distinctly the night before the last one just saying, I don't want to go. I don't want to do this again. I'm just starting to, I had 3 weeks between, and after that 3 weeks, you're starting to feel better, and then you have to go in, and then you feel really crappy again. But wasn't near as bad as I thought. I remember waking up the morning after the first treatment wondering, well, am I going to be sick? Am I going to be, you know, you hear of people just in the bathroom throwing up for days. I didn't have any of that, so it really wasn't the worst thing in the world. Not that I want to ever do it again, but it was not as bad as I thought it was going to be. So after that, then I started in on the radiation. Radiation, I did 6 weeks of radiation, 5 weeks for the full breast, and 1 week of concentrated on certain areas where the tumor had been. And that was simple. It was 90 seconds. I had to learn how to hold my breath so that my heart wouldn't get into the radiation. It took you longer to get undressed and get in there than it did to do the radiation. And then I drove. That was the hardest part with radiation, is I drove from Sioux Center to Sioux Falls every day. So it's 60-some-odd miles one way, and that was the worst part of it. I was tired of driving.
Then after that?
After that, I had routine mammograms, and that was pretty much it.
Nice.
I am finally 5 years free, and I can go back to having regular mammograms and not the super digital ones that they required for diagnostic services. So it's like I said, it's kind of a boring story, but
the boring is good.
It is good. It was fast and furious because we were in the middle of lots of stuff when I was doing it, which in the end probably helped because you're not thinking about it all the time. But that was pretty much it. And now I can go back to hopefully a normal life.
My mom is not here to listen to this episode because she lost her battle with cancer. She was anxious about mammograms, and so she avoided them. She did not seek out a physician when she noticed a lump in her breast. It was when the tumor had finally spread from her breast to her collarbone and ate through it that she finally went in. The now softball-sized tumor had spread through her body, and treatment could only prolong her life. She could not be saved at that point. In 2016, my mom passed away from her battle. These stories are important to tell. They give lessons to why we take safety and medical devices so seriously. And they tell us why the work of creating new treatments for these diseases are so important. My mom was 62 when she died. She may have had an extra 20 to 30 years of life ahead of her. Those in our field of medical product development continue to work so that others can have those years and more. We appreciate you listening to season 3. The recording for season 4 has already begun. Stay tuned.
This episode of Inside Out Quality was brought to you thanks to South Dakota Biotech Association. If you have a story you'd like us to explore and share, we'd love to hear from you. Submit your ideas by visiting www.sdbio.org.
You've made it this far in the episode. Thanks for listening.